This is White Collared, the podcast, season one, episode five, The Portrait. I would like to welcome you to White Collared, the podcast, which is a retrospective commentary on the USA Network television series White Collar. My name is Eric Alton Glenn Hilliard. To anyone who's written to me, posted comments or reviews, I do want to thank you. I am not necessarily able to acknowledge all of them at this point because I am recording a little bit ahead. So if you have been kind enough to leave a comment somewhere or send an email or a review, I am very much appreciative of it. And as soon as I get to the point where I can do so, I will acknowledge those. Now, I do have one feedback I would like to acknowledge. That is from Sherry DeFontenay. Sorry, I know I butchered that name. I apologize. But she is the admin and moderator for the White Collar Fandom group on Facebook. So if you are not a member of that group, be sure and check it out. It's a really good group. In her feedback, she commented about my comments from the pilot episode, specifically my take that Neil was a poor planner. And with her permission, I'd like to read some of her comment that she left for me. This is what she wrote. I think maybe we're discussing an issue of semantics to a degree. Let's take the prison escape, which you used as an example of overall poor planning, even though the escape itself was excellent, because his plan didn't allow for his continued freedom once he didn't find Kate at the apartment. But at worst, I'd call that maybe short-sighted, not an indictment against his planning abilities. He didn't have a plan beyond that we saw, because Kate thwarted the only thing he wanted to do. He may well have had plans to win her over again, or to look for her in some other locations, or whatever. But the thing he didn't count on was such a definitive goodbye waiting for him at the apartment. Once he saw that, nothing else mattered to him. So even if he had plans, he no longer had any interest in implementing them. And I know you even mentioned that he should have assumed that she would be gone a month and a half after she told him goodbye at the prison. But why? Assuming that it was just a normal breakup, she would have assumed that she had another 5 or 6 months to get herself out of the apartment because he would be locked up safe and sound. Surely she wouldn't have expected him to do something as foolish as escaping with so little time left to serve, which means, from his perspective, he has to escape because he likely figures she would be gone by the time he should have been released. Or maybe he already decided she only broke up with him because she's in some kind of trouble, so he thinks he can't wait because she needs him. I really don't disagree with Sherry on much of what she says. I believe that in some degree it is a semantical difference. But she uses the term short-sighted when she's talking about Neil's escape. Well, the definition of short-sighted is looking at the thing that's immediately in front of you and not looking and planning for those things that are beyond what is immediately in front of you. Not planning for those things. And to my definition, not planning is bad planning. Yes, he had an excellent plan for the escape. He didn't have an excellent plan in the larger sense, because the escape was only a solution to part of what was necessary for the plan. Because Neil's plan, as surmised from that episode, is that he wanted to reunite with Kate, he wanted to save the relationship, he wanted to fulfill the promise he made to her of a better life, and to not be that guy who keeps getting locked up for a half a decade at a time. Reuniting with her was only the first part of the plan. Breaking out of prison was only one possible way of accomplishing that. It's like the decision trees that you may have seen in a computer programming class or a logic class or in a business, where it's got all these little different shapes and all these lines coming off of it. And it's, you know, if this is true, then go this route. If this is not true, then go this route. And if you're not certain, then go this third route. And from each one of those are other additional decisions that could be made based on other factors and other evidence and other situations. And that's what I'm looking at, is that Neil didn't do that kind of a logic and planning of the possibilities. His response was more like just a straight line. There's only one option, break out of jail. Now, I think Sherry has an excellent grasp of what Neil's thinking probably was and the assumptions that he was making. And that's part of the problem. After all, you know what happens when you assume. You make an animal of the horse family, which is typically smaller than a horse and has long ears and a braying call, out of you and me. So for him to assume that Kate would still be there was an assumption that I think was unwarranted. And I base that on the fact that, as Sherry said, if it was a normal breakup, Kate would have assumed that she had about 4 or 5 months left. Well, it wasn't a normal breakup. We could see that from Neil's response. He was not expecting this. This was out of character for Kate. This was not normal behavior out of Kate, that as he understood it. Additionally, Kate presumably knows Neil well enough to anticipate his likely actions or anticipate that he might do something impulsive. So that would be a reason for her not to stay in the apartment if she thought he might do something, maybe break out, maybe have somebody try and keep tabs on her. So if her desire to end the relationship was genuine, she would have already done most of the work to disappear before breaking the news to Neil in prison in order to put him at a disadvantage if he wanted to do something like break out and find her or do something like have Mozzie keep tabs on her. So for Neil to assume that she would still be there because that would be normal is an assumption that I don't think he should have made. The other thing is that Sherry mentioned that, you know, maybe she only broke up with him because she's in some sort of trouble, and Neil understands this or anticipates this, or Neil thinks this might be the problem, so he doesn't think he can wait to get out of prison because she needs him right away. Well, it took him a month and a half to break out. Surely in the month and a half that it took him to accomplish the breakout, he could have contacted Mozzie or somebody else to verify a belief that she might be in trouble and he needs to be there immediately, can't wait that additional 2.5 months or so to finish his prison sentence. So I think that from the, shall we say, on the ground perspective, Sherry is dead on in her analysis. And I don't think we really disagree. I'm just looking at it from a higher level viewing down. So I think it's just a matter of Sherry and I are looking at it from different levels and different perspectives. But I do not disagree with anything that she said at all. And I do appreciate her comments because comments like this make me think. They make me go back and analyze what I have been thinking and to consider other possibilities, or at least consider other perspectives and see how they fit with what I've already said or what I believe. So thank you, Sherry. I appreciate the feedback. I appreciate the comments. And this is good. This is what I want to have. This is what I want to see from people is them coming along and having comments in response to what I say and even disagreeing with me. Let's get on to the actual details of the episode. The Portrait first aired on November 20th, 2009. It was written by Jeff Easton, the show's creator, and Travis Romero. It was directed by Alan Arkush. Sorry, Alan, I know I butchered that last name. I apologize. I'm really bad with names. A valuable painting is stolen from a young woman. Peter sets up a sting, but the thief escapes before the FBI can spring the trap. Neil and Peter track down the painting, and Neil steals the painting back from the thief, who, in turn, threatens the life of the gallery owner who helped them with the failed sting. But even if Peter and Neil do recover the painting, it may never be returned to the young woman from whom it was stolen. It seems that the painting may have been stolen years earlier by the young woman's grandmother, and the gallery that claims ownership wants it back. Meanwhile, the search for Kate continues as Neil follows clues which lead him to Grand Central Station. The episode begins with Neil and Mozzie outside of Grand Central Station.
Kate leaves you a bottle with a map on it, and this is where it leads us? Grand Central Station?
It's something I'd recognize, Moz. Something significant.
Significant? Grand Central Station!
Sound familiar.
She could have sent us anywhere, so she sends us to a place that leads everywhere?
Moz.
You know, there's a great oyster bar in there.
I think there's something in here.
X marks the spot again.
Kate likes the classics.
Dear Neil, Heard you're looking for me. Wish I could explain more, but time is not on our side. But you need to stop looking. No one can deny what we have, but it's over. Please move on. Kate.
All this for move on.
Initially, I accepted the notion that everything was on the up and up, that her leaving was genuine, and that she really didn't want to be found by Neil. But something about it just isn't adding up. Neil's comment, all of this for move on, really highlights the problem that is developing for me in Kate's disappearance. First of all, she tells Neil that the relationship is over, then takes off to the other side of the country, as we know from the fact that the ATM photo was taken in San Diego, and she changes her name. But she's left him messages and clues, which seemingly are designed to help him find her. It just doesn't fit. Let's look at the timeline for a minute. She left the bottle with the hidden map in the loft for Neil months earlier, before she left him, or as she was leaving him. But the fact that months earlier she left the clues on the bottle that leads Neil to the spot at Grand Central Station means that at that time, she intended to have a note or something else there for Neil to find. And she wouldn't have left the map on the bottle in the first place if she hadn't meant to entice him to look for her, or for whatever it was that she originally intended to leave at Grand Central Station for him to find. It's starting to seem more like a game or a tease. There is definitely something going on that just doesn't make sense if we accept the idea that Kate's breaking off the relationship and her disappearance is genuine. And it's pretty clear that Neil is starting to have his doubts about what's really going on as well. Well, after the Grand Central Station scene, we see Peter arriving at June's house, and Neil is on the rooftop patio. Peter tells Neil that they have an art theft. A painting by Haustenberg was stolen in a residential robbery, and this seems to impress Neil. He says, I'd like to meet the person who keeps a Haustenberg over their mantle. Now, as far as I can tell, Haustenberg was not a real artist. And this is also the conclusion of Aviva Bruckner, who is the author of a website, Strange Worlds Between. She writes that the painting, Young Girl with Locket, used in this episode, shows the same composition as Matisse's Young Woman with Blue Blouse. This is a piece from 1939 and is clearly expressionistic. The impressionistic influence on the painting, as used in the episode, might come from Renoir. Now, Bruckner offers an interesting hypothesis on the genealogy of the creation of the unseen character Haustenberg, but let me get to that in just a little bit. So in the meantime, as Peter and Neil are driving to the scene of the crime and in between Ford Taurus commercials, we get a few details of how Peter has been keeping tabs on Neil and some of his concerns about Neil in this particular case.
Haustenbergs are rare. Not many of his works made it out of Hungary after the war.
Yeah, rare can make it valuable. Very valuable.
What are you looking at me for?
Why do you think?
I didn't steal it.
I know you didn't steal it, but you like paintings. I'm worried that if we find it, maybe too much temptation for you.
I can handle temptation. You know I didn't steal it. You checked my anklet?
I always check your anklet. I pull a map up on you every day so I can see exactly where you've been.
Well, are you going to sulk now?
You don't trust me.
What did Reagan say? Trust but verify?
That was also the motto of the Soviet secret police.
Get used to it, comrade.
Contrary to what Neil says, based on what I can find, trust but verify was not the motto of the Soviet secret police. It may have been an unofficial motto, but I don't find any reference to it. Now, multiple sources reference this as being a Russian proverb that existed before the KGB. Now, according to the website Russia Beyond, the origins of this rhyming proverb, and in Russia, it is a rhyming proverb, or in Russian, it is a rhyming proverb. It is not in English, but the origins are difficult to trace. According to the website, the ultimate guide into Russian proverbs compiled and published by Vladimir Dahl in 1879 does not include this proverb. It means trust but verify had popped up only in the last years of the 19th century or the early 20th century. Vladimir Lenin voiced a version of the idea, although not as eloquently, in his 1914 speech. Do not take their word for it. Check it strictly. This is the slogan of the Marxist workers. Stalin repeated Lenin's idea years later. A healthy distrust is a good basis for working together. And the Soviet film Big Life from 1939 has that proverb word for word. Next, we meet Juliana, who, it seems, is feisty and fearless. After all, hitting the monster, as she called him, and being threatened with her life if she did it again, she did it again. I think that pretty much fits the definition of feisty and fearless. She also seems to be a little bit irresponsible in that she has a painting that is apparently worth millions of dollars hanging on the wall of her house, visible to anyone who comes in, yet it wasn't insured. When Juliana is out of the room momentarily, Peter and Neil are discussing Uncle Gary and how he seems to be the most likely person to be the insider for the robbery, because they've concluded it had to have been an inside robbery. So Neil convinces Peter to let him talk to Uncle Gary on the grounds that, since he is an FBI, and Uncle Gary's insistence that all FBI inquiries go through his lawyer, it doesn't apply to Neil. So he promises not to threaten or lie to Uncle Gary, albeit reluctantly with regard to the lying part.
Tell me, Gary, does Juliana know you helped steal the painting?
You can't be here. My lawyer was very clear.
First of all, hiring a lawyer makes you look guilty.
He told me specifically not to talk to the FBI.
Do I look like an FBI agent?
Who are you?
Think hard, Gary.
Did he send you?
What do you think?
God, I knew this would happen. What, that whole thing at the house was a setup?
How'd it go wrong? Juliana wasn't supposed to be there. Now she's a witness.
It wasn't my fault. Her class got out early. Please don't hurt her.
It's not me you need to convince.
Tell him I'll make sure she doesn't cause any trouble.
She's ready to sit with a sketch artist. This is the kind of thing that makes it much harder for him to sell the painting.
How about a good faith payment? Here's $300. That's all I got.
$300.
Gary. All right, you're right. I could write him a check.
That could work.
Well, here Neil is using the same technique on Uncle Gary that he used or tried to use on Peter in the car about Grand Central Station in the Oyster Bar. He asks essentially meaningless questions or makes meaningless statements that are truthful. He didn't lie. They're truthful. But they don't mean what the other person in the conversation infers they mean based on the context of the conversation. And this is a technique used by many people, advertisers, politicians, police officers, and con men, taking advantage of the tendency of people to not really listen to what is actually being said, to not actually think about the meaning of what is being said. It's actually surprisingly easy to convince people that something is being said that isn't actually being said, so that later, if and when the person making the statements or asking the questions is accused of having said this or that or, you know, some other thing, they can honestly say, I never said any of those things. You know, I'm sorry if that's what they thought I meant. That's not what I meant at all. I didn't say those things. So it's a way of lying truthfully. Now, later in a conference with Peter, Neil, Agent Jones, and a few other unidentified agents, we learn a little bit about the people behind the theft of the painting. First, there is Gerard Dorset, who is a French expat and who's into shaking down stockbrokers. He's into high-end loan sharking and making questionable loans with big corporate money. And presumably, he is the brains behind the operation because the other person, Joshua, is the ex-military muscle. And as we clearly see in the video, the recipient of several well-placed punches to the face by Juliana. We also meet Taryn Vandersant, who is a buyer at the Lambert Gallery that Dorset apparently contacted trying to sell the painting, and who convinced him that she had a wealthy client who was interested in the painting. Now, it's interesting that Dorset is only asking $100,000 for the painting. This seems an awful low price for a painting that is reportedly worth $2.6 million. My guess is that Uncle Gary got in touch with him, spilled the beans about his talk to Neil, and realizing that Uncle Gary compromised him, Dorset decided he needed to dump the painting fast, and that would mean selling it for far less than he could get if he had more time to find a good buyer. I also have to wonder about Uncle Gary's health these days. Now, a little bit about the Lambert Gallery. The Lambert Gallery is, or was, an actual place. In 1966, Yvonne Lambert opened his first gallery on the Rue de l'Echade. Sorry, I do not speak foreign languages. Anyway, he opened that in Paris, France, where he began to exhibit American artists. He showed founders of conceptualism, minimalism, and land art, such as Carl Andre and Lawrence Weiner. In 2003, Lambert founded a new gallery in Chelsea, New York, and then relocated to West 21st Street in 2005, or in 2007. Depends on the source you reference. Now, the New York gallery closed in 2011, and then the Paris gallery closed in December of 2014. Back to Neil and his apartment. Neil's in his apartment. He does the Mad magazine fold-in with the note from Kate, which makes it read, "Here, Friday, noon," and which is now considerably more wrinkled than it was when he pulled it out of the hiding place in the girder of the overpass in front of Grand Central Station. So I would guess he was carrying it around in his pocket trying to figure out what was going on with it, at least for a little while. Now, in the discussion for the episode of Threads, I mentioned that Peter doesn't have a lot of use for the trappings of wealth, nor for the pretentiousness of some so-called modern art, such as an oversized load of laundry, as he calls it, that sells for $120,000. He also doesn't care for Haustenberg's work. He calls it cartoony. Neil calls Peter a Philistine, to which Peter replies, "Yeah, I'm the crazy one," as he looks right at the $120,000 load of laundry. Neil and Taryn Van Der Sant meet Dorset in the gallery, and in what I think has to be a callback to the pilot, Neil chooses to go by the name DeVore. Now, the conversation hits a slight bump when DeVore asks how long Neil and Taryn have known each other. She clearly wasn't expecting that question, and she didn't seem to know how to handle it. And I think that a guy that is as smart and experienced at cons as Dorset is had to have picked up on that. And of course, once he sees the FBI agents outside the door of the gallery, trying to act casual and trying to act like they aren't FBI agents, he probably realizes he's been set up.
I've got fluorescing cadmium green and azurite blue. That puts the paint composition pre-1960.
Perhaps you can explain why there are people signaling each other outside. Who are they?
If you brought the FBI into this...
It was not me!
I told you to keep a low profile.
We're careless. You've been flashing this painting all over town. They followed you here.
Something is not right here.
Damn right it's not.
My time and inconvenience.
When Dorset accuses Neil and Taryn of bringing the FBI along with them, Neil does what I guess you could say is the logical thing. He accuses Dorset of having done it. As the saying goes, the best defense is a strong offense. Now, in their conversation prior to him being suspicious, Dorset had mentioned the so-called butterfly effect when he says that butterflies flap their wings and they can set off hurricanes. Well, one of the best ways to understand a complex idea is to make it easy to understand by metaphor. And that's what the term butterfly effect was created to attempt to do. From the website How Stuff Works, the term butterfly effect was coined in the 1960s by Edward Lorenz, a meteorological professor at Massachusetts Institute of Technology who was studying weather patterns. He devised a model demonstrating that if you compare two starting points indicating current weather that are near each other, they'll soon drift apart, and later, one area could wind up with severe storms while the other is calm. At that time, weather statisticians thought you should be able to predict future weather based on looking at historical records to see what happened when conditions were the same as they are now. Lorenz was skeptical. He was running a computer program to test various weather simulations, and he discovered that rounding off one variable from 0.506127 to 0.506 dramatically changed the 2 months of weather predictions in his simulation. A variable of 0.506127 to 0.506 isn't hugely significant in and of itself, but the rounding of that made a significant difference in the result long term. Now, his point was that long-range weather forecasting was virtually impossible, in large part because humans don't have the ability to measure nature's incredible complexity. There are simply too many minute variables that can act as pivot points, cascading into much bigger consequences. So while people often mistakenly think the butterfly effect means that tiny changes can have big consequences, and we can track this progression to see what change caused what Lorenz was really trying to say is that we can't track these changes. We don't really know exactly what sort of trigger would cause a weather pattern to go one way over another. Later, other scientists realized the importance of Lorenz's discovery. His insights laid the foundation for a branch of mathematics known as chaos theory, the idea of trying to predict the behavior of systems that are inherently unpredictable. The term butterfly effect isn't really meant to imply that a butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil could actually cause a tornado in Texas. It's just meant to illustrate that a small event at the right time and in the right place could, in theory, combine with other factors and ultimately culminate in a much different action elsewhere than would have happened if that small event hadn't happened. Anyway, back to the episode. After the sting goes sideways, Peter is talking to Elizabeth about it and the potential consequences of having lost $100,000 of the Bureau's money.
The thing about Neil, nothing is ever what it seems. Guy's a contradiction. He's obsessed about Kate, but you should have seen him flirting with this girl at the takedown.
But honey, that's who Neil is. That's never gonna change. That's what I love about you so much.
What? That I lost all ability to flirt when we got married?
Honey, it was even questionable then.
It was.
Who's the new girl?
Taryn Van Der Zandt. She's a buyer at the Lambert Gallery. She's beautiful. Seems nice.
Well, if Neil's interested, you should encourage it.
Encourage it? Oh, I need that like a hole in the head.
Honey, if he falls for the new girl, he might actually stop chasing Kate.
You and Taryn were getting along pretty good yesterday.
She's not my type.
What? Not your... Why isn't she your type? She loves art. She looks like Laura Croft in khakis.
Really? Does she bake cookies for orphans, too?
She does.
I get it. Meet a nice girl, maybe settle down.
Simplify my life, probably save yours.
You're lying about the cookies.
Prove it.
I've said before that Peter's relationship with Elizabeth is such that he uses her as a sounding board and for feedback in his cases, and that is something that the FBI probably wouldn't approve of. And here we see that her feedback actually changes his mind. Initially, he is not only confused by Neil's flirting with Taryn while simultaneously obsessing over Kate, but he also thinks that the possibility of Neil being seriously interested in Taryn could be troublesome for him. But as has happened in the past, Elizabeth is able to redirect his thinking, making Peter understand that maybe a Neil-Taryn relationship could actually be a good thing for both Peter and Neil. After Peter and Elizabeth's conversation, Peter and Neil are going into the office, walking through the office, and Peter's trying to promote the idea of Neil getting together with Taryn, and they're on their way to a meeting with Walter, the curator of the Channing Museum. Now, he spars a bit with Neil over the painting, not having been listed in the Art Loss Registry. Now, the Art Loss Registry is a real thing, which currently lists over 700,000 works of art. But, contrary to what Neil states, Walter was correct in that the registry was established in 1990, not 1991. The sparring between Neil and Walter continues when Walter says that the Matisse influence is apparent in the Haustenberg. Neil disagrees, and rather rudely and arrogantly at that, especially considering that he just got the establishment date of the Art Loss Registry wrong. He says, considering Matisse was a Fauvist, I wouldn't agree with that at all. Unless you're talking about his early works, which I don't think you are, and if you are, you're just wrong. Let's talk about the Fauvist movement here for just a second. According to artstory.org, Fauvism, which was the first 20th century movement in modern art, was initially inspired by the examples of Vincent van Gogh, Paul Gauguin, Georges Seurat, probably butchered that name really, really badly, and Paul Cézanne. The Fauves, or wild beasts, were a loosely allied group of French painters with a shared interest. Several of them, including Henri Matisse, Albert Marquet, and Georges Rouault, again, butchering names, I'm sorry, they had all been pupils of the symbolist artist Gustave Moreau, and admired the older artist's emphasis on personal expression. Matisse emerged as the leader of the group, whose members shared the use of intense color as a vehicle for describing light and space, and who redefined pure color and form as a means of communicating the artist's emotional state. In these regards, Fauvism proved to be an important precursor to Cubism and Expressionism, as well as a touchstone for future modes of abstraction. One of Fauvism's major contributions to modern art was its radical goal of separating color from its descriptive, representational purpose and allowing it to exist on the canvas as an independent element. Color could project a mood and establish a structure within the work of art without having to be true to the natural world. Another of Fauvism's central artistic concerns was the overall balance of the composition. The Fauvist simplified forms and saturated colors drew attention to the inherent flatness of the canvas or paper. Within that pictorial space, each element played a specific role. The immediate visual impression of the work is to be strong and unified. Above all, Fauvism valued individual expression. The artist's direct experience of his subjects, his emotional response to nature, and his intuition were all more important than the academic theory or elevated subject matter. All elements of the painting were employed in service of this goal. Now, one of the first images I saw when researching Fauvism was Henri Matisse's Woman with a Hat from 1905, and it actually reminded me very much of work I remembered from artist Peter Max. Peter Max was known more for his pop art, much in the style used in works such as the Beatles movie Yellow Submarine, and in Max's posters from the 1980 Olympics, really wasn't Fauvist, but I'm thinking more along the lines of his works such as Vase of Flowers, or Abstract Flowers 2, or Umbrella Man. And although I'm not knowledgeable on art, I doubt these would be called Fauvist works. But to my untrained eye, there do seem to be some stylistic similarities. But back to the episode. After Walter explains that the painting belongs to the Channing Museum and he wants it back and he doesn't care about anybody else who had it because it doesn't matter that it was stolen from them if it was stolen from him first, Neil has a conversation with Juliana.
You're not a very good liar. Your grandmother stole the painting.
Why would you say that?
She never had it insured. That was my first clue.
Is this like a good cop, bad cop thing? He takes a call, you wink at me.
If we get the painting, it's going back to the Channing. Unless you give us a good reason to keep it away from them. Right. Tell me a story. How'd she take it? Just hypothetically.
Hypothetically? A little black dress, a laced bottle of whiskey, and a horny Irish security guard.
Why'd you do it? That's the locket. Your grandmother's a little girl in the painting.
That's right. Juliana's grandmother was the woman in the painting. Okay, now, I'd mentioned earlier Aviva Bruckner, author of the website Strangers Between Worlds. Now, she offers an interesting hypothesis on the genealogy of the creation of the unseen character Haustenberg. To quote, who might this Hungarian post-impressionist be? Haustenberg is Laszlo Mednyansky. He's well known for his impressionistic influence in his work. Furthermore, in Hungarian, it is custom to write the last name first and then the given name, or the family name first and then the given name. So, Laszlo Mednyansky would be Mednyansky Laszlo, as in Juliana Laszlo, the granddaughter of Haustenberg. Now, a couple things about Laszlo Mednyansky. He actually predated Haustenberg, or the time that Haustenberg supposedly lived. Mednyansky died shortly after World War I, whereas the fictional Haustenberg survived World War II. So they were separated by about a generation. And among the works that I could find by Mednyansky, I could not find any that directly resembled the painting Young Girl with Locket that was used in the episode. However, I did find, in terms of composition, a similar piece called Peasant Boy with Hat, which, although stylistically, was different, because Mednyansky and Haustenberg are very different in their styles. As a side note, one thing we learn about Juliana from this scene is that, like her grandmother, she cares more about sentiment than money. Her grandmother never had the painting insured, and neither did Giuliana, despite the fact that the painting was worth millions of dollars. Granted, by trying to insure it, she would have to deal with the issue of the theft of the painting from the Channing Gallery decades earlier. But even just based on what she's revealed about the painting's history at this point in the episode, I think she could have put up a good case. Now, at this point, Dorset has dropped off the radar. So Peter decides to try and find him by trying to find Brigitte. After going through the customs list, they narrow the list of possible Brigittes down to 7. Neil quickly volunteers to check out the Brigitte staying at the Ganzevoort. Now, the Ganzevoort is at 9th and 13th Streets in New York in the Meatpacking District. The 186-room hotel features a full-service ground-floor restaurant, year-round rooftop bar and restaurant, a 45-foot heated outdoor pool, and indoor and outdoor spaces where guests can enjoy unobstructed 360-degree views of the Manhattan skyline. Room prices start at over $300 a night and can go up to over $1,600 a night. Just the kind of place that Neil would like. Peter and Neil stake out the hotel, and Neil, of course, isn't happy about having to sit in the car and just watch. Old school, as Peter calls it. Neil's attitude gets worse when Peter pulls out a sandwich. Deviled ham. Now, frankly, I like deviled ham. But more importantly, this again highlights Peter's perspective on things. He's a guy who can find enjoyment in simple things and doesn't understand the compulsion to live the opulent and self-indulgent lifestyle. Peter also reveals that not only does he check Neil's anklet on a daily basis, he keeps tabs on him in other ways, such as the fact that he knows that Neil recently acquired a gold credit card. Peter lets Neil go into the hotel restaurant, probably just to get rid of him for a while more than anything else, but while he's in the restaurant, Neil meets Brigitte and manages to get him and Peter invited up to her hotel room. Up in Brigitte's hotel room, Neil breaks into the master suite against Peter's wishes and direct orders and finds the painting. He steals it and leaves an origami butterfly in its place, which of course is a message to Dorset referencing Dorset's earlier comments about butterflies and a butterfly being an expression for a man who flits from flower to flower and how Neil could be quite successful as a butterfly. He also finds the inscription on the back of the painting to Giuliana's grandmother. I'd mentioned before that I thought that from what Giuliana, the granddaughter, had revealed about the painting's history, that I thought she could put up a good case for claiming ownership. Now, during legal wranglings for the painting, no doubt the painting would have been examined by multiple experts, and this inscription surely would have been found in the process, which I think would have pretty much solidified her claim against the Channing. So again, I have to think that the fact that she didn't go this route shows that the painting means more to her personally than the money ever would have. Now, I'm not saying that she knew about the inscription, but had she pursued it, had she been interested in the money aspects of it, the value aspects of the painting, surely she would have had the painting examined at some point and it would have been discovered, this inscription. So I have to think that she was operating from a point of integrity, and I have to admire that in her. Now, the next morning, Dorset returns to the hotel and discovers that the painting is missing and finds the origami butterfly in its place. Later, Jones calls Peter to tell him that they've lost track of Dorset. Well, Neil kind of has an idea where Dorset is, or at least what he's up to, because when he's in his apartment, he gets a call from Dorset.
What is this?
I could ask you the same thing. You seem to have many names, George.
Dorset, how'd you get this number?
You bought my girlfriend a drink with your credit card. I'm impressed with your resourcefulness. Now you will see mine. I want the painting. If it is not returned, Joshua will pay a visit to your beautiful friend at the gallery.
You leave her out of this.
Brigitte was out of bounds, yet you involved her. You set the rules, now you must play by them.
I need 2 days.
That's all you have.
You stole the painting?
I was going to give it back to Giuliana.
You're like a child, no sense of consequence. And you're Robin Hood. And did I forget to mention the part where you stole the painting?
I didn't think Dorset would get away.
This is because you don't like the guy from the Channing. You did this for spite.
I've done things for less.
Once again, we see a problem being created because rather than plan, Neil tries to improvise and tactically tries to solve a problem, an immediate problem, without considering how his short-term solution to an immediate problem will impact the longer-term strategic plan. Or as Mozzie puts it, no sense of consequence. So what would have happened if he'd left the painting? Obviously, we don't know. But we do know what happened because he took the painting. Dorset threatens Taryn Vandersant's life. And at this point, Neil only has one solution to the problem. He has to admit the truth to Peter.
I took the painting.
Damn it, Neil.
I wasn't going to... I did it for... We can use it to catch Dorset. He doesn't know I work for you.
We'll set it up tomorrow. Now get the hell out of my house.
Yeah. Night, Elizabeth.
Night, Neil. Well, he told you the truth about the painting.
Because they threatened Taryn.
Start.
Yeah. It's a start.
We see that Elizabeth, it's not a matter of that she has faith in Neil, but and because obviously he screwed up and she has to recognize that fact. But she has faith in Neil in as much as she sees him progressing. He admitted the truth. Now, granted, he was kind of forced into the situation because of his actions. He was dealing with consequences of his actions. But he did admit the truth to Peter. And she sees this as a good thing. She sees this as progress. She is in Neil's corner. She is rooting for him, big time. Well, Neil already said that he wants to give the painting back to Juliana. So, to that end, he decides to forge a copy of the painting. And, of course, we can guess that he intends to give the fake to Walter, the curator of the Channing Museum. Now, Neil is clearly not taking the creation of the forgery very seriously. In fact, that becomes a point of contention between him and Mozzie, who seems quite irritated by Neil's lackadaisical attitude about the forgery, which is undoubtedly coupled with his irritation about Neil having stolen the painting in the first place. No sense of consequence. You think you're Robin Hood. That's where Mozzie's at right now with Neil. Well, the next morning, the bust of Dorset goes off without a hitch. But we see that Neil did, in fact, give Dorset the forgery, which, of course, the FBI recovered during the bust, and then gave to Walter, the curator of the Channing Museum. Now, when Walter realizes that the painting is a forgery, or it looks wrong to him, presumably, and he suspects it might be a forgery, he flips the painting over to verify in his own mind that it's the legitimate painting by looking at the inscription on the back, which, of course, willed the painting to the grandmother of Juliana. And, of course, what Walter finds there is the note that Neil left for him, which essentially is a veiled threat to keep his mouth shut and never pursue the matter. In the meantime, Neil returns the real painting to the granddaughter, Juliana. However, I can't help but think that Peter knows that Neil did something. But I think he also knows that he doesn't know what Neil did, how he would prove what he did, or even if he would want to prove what he did, even if he really did know what Neil did, or if he even wants to know what Neil did. Did that make sense? Yeah, I think that made sense. Anyway, Peter knows that something's not right, but it's one of those ignorance is bliss type things. After the case is over, after Dorset is busted, after Juliana gets the painting back, and Walter is sent back with the fake, Neil returns to Grand Central Station at noon on Friday, as he believes the note from Kate directed him to do.
Forbidden romantic meetings are kind of a personal thing, Maz.
Yeah, like I was going to let you come alone. What if the guy with the ring planted that note? You'll be happy I came when a red laser dot suddenly appears on your forehead.
Enough with the hero talk, Haversham.
Okay.
Kate?
Neil, I don't have a lot of time. He's close.
The man with the ring?
Yes. Listen, I need you to tell me where you hid everything.
What?
The money, the bonds, the art, all of it.
Why?
He wants something. Something you took, something you hid.
I hid a lot of things.
Well, then give him everything. If he gets what he wants, he'll let me come back to you.
Who is he?
I can't tell you. Too dangerous for you.
Dangerous? Why? Kate, just tell me. I can protect you.
This is the only way you can help me.
You always told me I had to trust you.
Well, now you have to trust me. I want to come home.
Please just tell me where you hid everything.
No.
I want to come home.
It's the only leverage I got. Just stay there, okay? I'm coming up. Neil! Neil! Kate?
Mozzie, tell Neil I love him. Tell him it's the only way.
Mozzie's paranoia is on full display here. And I can't necessarily say I disagree with him. He's got a valid point. Now, granted, his paranoia may be a little over the top, but I would say it's probably not that far over the top under the circumstances. Now, before I comment about this particular scene in detail, I do want to talk about payphones. I think there's a lot of people out there who have no clue as to what a payphone is, or was, rather. With the advent of the Apple iPhone, the Google Android phones, and the declining use of physical currency, the use of public payphones has declined quickly over the last 10 years or so. In fact, a few remained standing in New York as late as 2020, earlier in the year, but many of those, perhaps most of them, were not operational. Now, according to the Smithsonian Magazine, the first payphone was invented by William Gray and developed by George A. Long, with one of the first ones being installed on the corner of Main Street and Central Row in downtown Hartford, Connecticut in 1889. The backstory here is that by the 1880s, the telephone was a critical component of American infrastructure, but the man on the street looking to make a phone call had to locate one of the relatively rare agent-operated telephone pay stations and pay a fee to make a call. This could be a great inconvenience, as one William Gray would find out in 1888. The son of a Scottish immigrant, Gray was an amateur tinkerer in Hartford who was best known for designing an improved chest protector for baseball catchers that became the game's standard in the 1890s. As for the payphone, though, the story goes that Gray was inspired to create it when, depending on who you ask, either his boss, his neighbor, or the workers at a nearby factory refused to let him use their phone to call a doctor for his ailing wife. Eventually, Gray found a phone and his wife recovered, but he was left with an idea: public telephones. After numerous failed attempts, Gray developed a satisfactory mechanism that used a small bell to signify the operator when a coin was deposited, which would grant the individual the opportunity to make a call. In 1891, Gray set up the Gray Telephone Pay Station Company and began installing phones on posts and in cabinets across America. He continued to refine his creation, eventually racking up more than 20 patents related to the payphone, including innovations related to toll apparatuses, coin holders, call registers, and signaling devices. 100 years later, there were more than 2 million payphones installed in the United States. And although they could still be profitable in recent years, particularly in places where cell phone or landline coverage was not available, by 2018, there were only 100,000 remaining across the country. Now, let's talk about this scene. There are a lot of conflicting clues and a lot of conflicting information here. While one can make the argument that there was a reason that the man with the ring didn't want Kate or Neil to know specifically what he was looking for, it seems more reasonable that he would have told Kate what it was that he was looking for so she could ask Neil where that specific thing was. To simply have her ask where he hid everything seems a bit vague. It assumes that everything is hidden in one place, discounting the real possibility and the rational probability that an intelligent thief would spread his stash across multiple locations, thus reducing the likelihood of losing everything if his stash was located or was compromised, because it would only be one of several and would only have part of his stash. The best reason I could think of for the man with the ring not wanting Neil or Kate to know specifically what he was looking for would be because knowing what that thing is would reveal his identity. But Kate already knows his identity since the ATM photos seem to show the two of them together and out in public. So it doesn't seem likely that he would have been able to hide his identity from her in that sort of a setting. And the photo is completely without context. So not only do we not have any idea of the identity of the man with the ring, we really don't know from the photograph anything about his relationship to Kate. Everything is just assumptions that are not based on any real facts. Now, another possible reason why the man with the ring might not want Neil or Kate to know specifically what he was looking for would be because of its value, perhaps being more than Neil realizes, or in a way that Neil doesn't realize. But if Kate means as much to Neil as it seems, it doesn't seem reasonable that Neil wouldn't be willing to trade it for Kate, regardless of its value. And if that were the aim, then once again, we're back to it being more likely that the man with the ring would tell Kate and Neil what it was that he wanted and simply arrange a swap. Then there's the change of her wording. Maybe I'm making more of this than is there, but it does seem suspicious that early in her phone call, she says, he wants something. Give him everything. If he gets what he wants, he'll let me come back to you. But then it becomes, just tell me where you hid everything. Now, as I say, I'm reading more into this than is there, or that more than is intended to be there. But it does seem an odd change of focus from him to her. From him wanting to know to her wanting to know, from telling him where the stuff is at, telling her where the stuff is at. Perhaps it's an unintentional admission that maybe she's more involved in this than she wants Neil to believe. It's just a slip of the tongue. It's what they call a Freudian slip. She accidentally revealed a true motive. But it ends up in a stalemate. Neil refuses to divulge the location. He's insisting that by refusing to reveal the location and by holding the information as leverage, that's the only way he can get Kate back. And Kate is insisting that revealing the information is the only way for him to get Kate back. And yet the look on her face when Neil tells her no seems to be a genuine look of heartbreak. And it couldn't have possibly been for Neil's benefit because he was too far away for him to really read her expression. And the expression is still on her face. Even after Neil drops the phone receiver and Mozzie picks it up while Neil tries to run after Kate. So I don't know about you, but at this point, even though I want to believe that Kate is an innocent victim in all of this, there's just too much conflicting information and some of her actions just don't make sense in the context of her being an innocent victim in all of this. She left Neil the bottle with the map, which directed Neil to a note, and the note led Neil to a meeting with her, only to have demands made of him by some apparently unknown individual. As much as I might not want to, at this point, I have to reconsider my previously held belief that Kate was an innocent victim in all of this. And I have to at least consider the possibility that the whole thing is a scam and that Kate is either behind it or a willing participant in it. After all, Kate knows better than anybody probably Neil's tendency to act on impulse and without planning out beyond the immediate need. And this situation seems to be designed to get Neil to act on impulse, designed to get Neil to agree to give up the information in order to get Kate back. And if that is the deal, is Neil throwing a spanner in the works by not impulsively agreeing to give up his stash? Or is refusing to give it up and attempting to use it as leverage his impulsive act? I don't know. Hopefully, in future episodes, we'll find out. But as it is, this is the end of the portrait. As always, I will be providing links to all the resources I've mentioned in the show at whitecollaredpc.com and also in the show notes. And I will also be providing probably some additional links to other resources that I utilized in my research, but didn't necessarily directly mention. Once again, I would like to thank Sherry DeFontaine. Sherry, I'm sorry. I know I'm butchering that name. But I would like to thank her for her feedback and her permission to use her comments her comments of challenging my position. And again, I don't know that we're all that far apart on what we think, Sherry. I think we're just looking at it from different perspectives and coming to different conclusions. But that's all. Anyway, on the website there at whitecollaredpc.com, you can find ways to communicate with me and the show. I will also have a link to the White Collar Fandom Facebook group where you can join in the discussion with Sherry and myself and others. And if you would do me one favor, if there's anything about the show that you enjoy, even if there's a lot of things that you don't enjoy about the show, if there's anything about the show that you do enjoy, do me the favor of sharing this podcast with a friend. That will help grow the podcast and the listenership of this in far more ways than just about anything else that you could do. Reviews on iTunes and other places really don't do a whole lot, but sharing it with your friends and acquaintances who love white collar, like you do, like I do, that will help this podcast more than you can possibly imagine. That being said, thank you for listening to this episode, and please be sure and join me for the next episode as I share my thoughts on episode number 6, entitled All In. But until then, take care and God bless.